Welcome to Through the Web podcast with me, your host, Tosif.
And me, Cold Fusion, otherwise known as Tagogo.
How have you been?
I've been good. A little sick, but I've gotten over that now. So I just got the cough remaining. How about yourself?
No cough yet. Brandon just got off his cold, spicy flu. I've still been okay so far, touch wood, but it's just going around everywhere right now.
It is. That's that season.
Yeah, it feels like, when was the last time we sat down together in this room? Probably 3 weeks
now? 1965.
that's how long it feels like, to be fair. But honestly, I keep saying it back over and over again. Like every time we do a remote one and then come back to do an in-studio, it's just so much better.
Yeah, this is the real deal.
100%. But other than that, what have you been up to overall?
Well, I'm leaving to Europe quite soon. So I'm just finishing off a few videos for the lovely audience to watch while I'm away to keep them entertained. So there's some good stuff coming up.
It's the life of a creator. No actual break.
Well, there will be a break when I go. Yeah. but yeah, fair enough. Like all your work gets compressed into.
Do you ever feel scared, like, you know, that if you don't upload, you'll just kind of disappear into the abyss?
Yeah, because that kind of happened. So back in, it would have been like 2013, like I went to America and Canada for about a month and a bit, and
yeah,
just didn't upload anything. And so I didn't know at the time that that was a bad thing. I thought, like, you know, they're your subscribers, so they get notified on everything. So there was a big drop off and it took a long time to come back after that. So I kind of learned my lesson.
Well, did you do anything differently to come back on, you know, regular schedule? Or was just...
No, I think I just started uploading again.
Right.
I did do a video saying I'm back. Yeah. Just to, like, you know, literally that was the title. just let
everyone know that you're alive.
Yeah, so. But it wasn't that, didn't really work. So I just kind of uploaded.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy how, I think it's maybe changing a little bit now. But YouTube is to, like, punish if you didn't upload on a regular basis.
Yeah. And those, and then people were getting burnt out because, like, you know, if you were someone like an animator or something, like that takes time.
100%.
You just got to keep doing it or else you'd die.
But then I wonder, how does it work for some other creators who only maybe post once a month or maybe even once every 3-4 months, right?
Yeah.
What's his name? Bill Wirtz or something? The guy, the funny guy.
Bill Burr.
No. He did the entire history of the world video.
Oh, yes.
Thing. Yeah, he only drops maybe something every once a year or something. It always goes viral. No,
that's true. And those are the gems. And also Lemino, I don't know if you know him as well. Yep, he's very rare. And his videos always hit.
Even Mr. Beast, he's doing like very infrequent uploads as well.
Yeah, so that's maybe something to look at. I'm actually not sure how that works.
Yeah, maybe I think you need to have like a certain threshold of followers or subscribers in this case for you to gain something. But
yeah, but the thing is, like, if you subscribe to a channel and you stop watching their videos, like, I'm sure, like, you've noticed as well, they don't appear anymore on your feed. So I don't think that's the main thing. It must just be, you know, when they release a video, like, enough people still must have watched something recently because it just got such a big following that it just still picks up, maybe.
And apparently YouTube's also saying that, you know, so the subscriber count is getting a lot less important than viewer count. So the whole subscriber count is basically a vanity metric. Just say, you know, you've got X amount of subscribers. But then for a channel that's been around for 10 plus years, I mean, it's so many people who would have subscribed ages ago. And I don't know how many channels I'm subscribed to either.
There was a channel recently, which I kind of leaned to, who said, you know, oh, good stuff. He texted me on Twitter, right? And he had like 10 million, I think, or something like that.
Was this?
That guy who just messaged me on Twitter, like, I can't say the name.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes.
And, when you go on his videos, there's, like, you know, less than 100,000.
Yes.
You know, per, so, you know, it can happen, and it's interesting when it does. But I think it's very true. Like, subscriber count is only, like, a vanity thing. So there's this channel, Rick Beato.
The musician.
So he just got over 3 million, and he's, like, the only reason I was pushing people to subscribe is because it gets me more, like, it makes me look more legitimate. So I can get interviews with like people like Sting or like whoever.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So I believe it's like, a bit of an advertising, you know, this channel is.
Credibility.
Yeah.
But then again, with all that kind of stuff, it's like there's so much bubble, like so many bubbles, right? Like so many, like people with 10, 15 million subscribers and you don't even know who they are, right?
That's true.
And I think people are slowly beginning to realize that, because previously there'd be like, oh, you know, like you've got 1 million subscribers, oh, you're a huge, huge deal kind of thing. Which you are, but within a certain niche. Yeah. And I think the top 1% of, you know, creators also have somewhat of a mainstream kind of relevance, if that makes sense.
I think the people that manage to break out, you know, by going and doing their own thing, or whether it's like going a little backwards into TV and appearing there or whatever, just the fact that it's not just YouTube, I think that kind of sets them apart.
That's right. Yeah, but like I said, with the Rick Beato guy, like he also interviews lots of established musicians, right? But there are others like him who don't, and who kind of just live in that little YouTube, I'm not little to say, you know, in a negative way, but in their own kind of circle, whereas there are others who kind of break out. So quite interesting stuff.
Yes.
So what have you been watching this week, if anything at all?
Look, I didn't think about that before we started. But let's
Stranger Things, obviously.
Well, yeah, Stranger Things. I did finish it off, but you know, just in case anyone.
How'd you manage? Because you only finished it last night. Yes. So how'd you manage to stay off of any spoilers?
That's a good question. I guess just didn't see anything.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. So I don't know. Maybe I just followed too much tech stuff, and it's like, you know, just didn't come into the fray. I don't know.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So
are you one to kind of go back and like watch, I don't know, like breakdowns and Easter egg videos and on stuff?
Yeah, I am. Haven't had a chance to do that yet. Right. But for things that I really enjoy, that's...
Because I usually do that, and I think that's why I keep getting recommendations, and that's why I end up getting spoilers ahead of time. Right, yeah, so that's why I go like really crazy before something like that I'm really keen to watch comes out. So the fact that you've waited, what, 2 weeks now?
Yeah, since the... but it was worth it, man. Like, it was definitely because I wanted to be ready. You know, I could just sit down and, you know, just really take it in. So it was worth it.
Yeah, no, it's what a show, though.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, I was just telling you beforehand, it's like a testament to story writing. This is how you make something that is just epic. You know, it can be 2.5 hours and it doesn't feel like that at all.
Yeah.
You know, the beats are just right. It doesn't drag. It's like, you know, the way they've crafted this story and interwoven all the parts, it's not easy. You had like five different stories going on, but it all worked. So, what are the brothers called? What's their name?
Duffer Brothers.
Duffer Brothers, yeah. Good job on them.
Like, yeah, and also how good was the choices of the music in this season? Incredible.
Yeah.
You've picked that up as a musician, isn't it?
Of course. When I can't say the part.
Next 30 seconds. Next 30 seconds. Oh, no, I think we should just skip it all together.
Yeah, no. Like, there's a certain song that comes on. A certain person playing a guitar. That was just great. Like, that moment was epic.
It was very good. But overall, I thought, like I said, it's just storytelling was incredible. And one thing I've noticed is sometimes people get more disappointed on the finale than the penultimate episode. Mm-hmm. Because I think...
Sorry, I don't know. This thing's annoying me. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, it's all good.
I was just saying that sometimes people get a little bit more disappointed on the finale over the penultimate episode. I think that's because, I don't know, like maybe the build up before the finale, it's just so like, you know, heightened, everything's on the cliffhanger, but then the finale is the resolution, or mostly the resolution of those things. So that's why some people just get a little bit deflated when a show or season ends. I think that's what a lot of people felt towards, like, oh, the previous episode was way better. Or even some people felt the volume one was way better than volume two because of how, I guess, it left things for volume two.
Well, are you saying that people were disappointed by the end of Stranger Things?
No, I mean, they weren't. Like, but I'm saying in general, I've heard this as a common theme.
General theme.
And I've heard people say that they enjoyed the episode before the final episode or before the finale more than they enjoyed the finale. So, I thought that was an interesting, I guess, outlook. But what else did you watch?
So I don't know if you've heard of BeamNG Drive.
I haven't, no.
So it's like a racing simulator. It's literally just, it's really cool. So it's like a simulator of like just car mechanics and crash physics and everything to do with a car. So like basically people make up crazy scenarios. And so for example, there was this guy that was like, what would it be like to have a one-ton flywheel in a car? So like, you know, okay. This is a video game, not real, but you know, so like, oh. So what happens is like, he's revving forever and it's just like, eh, and he dumps the clutch and the car's just like, just takes off in one gear, just like forever. And you know, like driving a car with square wheels or like, you know, just like crazy stuff.
Right.
But yeah, the thing about this simulator is it was just been in like development for like a decade. And, you know, it's not even at version one yet. It's like still in beta. Oh, I think it might be 1.0 something. Mm. But the crash physics are the best I've ever seen in any game.
Wow.
Because like everything is like rigid body modeled. So it's like, you know, to the T, like what would happen in a real physics, you know. So people have done crash tests in real life and done the same scenario, video footage of one versus the other, and they look the same.
Wow.
It's like, so I just... And when I'm watching this, I'm just thinking, why can't all racing games be this in depth? But then I think about like maybe, you know, say Mercedes or Ferrari or whatever, they don't want to have their cars damaged in a video game. So that's why all the damage is so like petty nowadays. You know,
you can reckon?
Like, what do you call it? Even Forza, there's no damage. Or like Gran Turismo 7, like if you crash at 300 miles an hour, it's just like a scratch.
Oh,
like,
true,
so
true.
It's there's not actual damage. Because this one is like, you know, plastic deformation, like tires pop, like, yeah. You know, clutch can burn out, engine can overheat. It's like everything is really
real.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just a bit disappointing because you see this thing and it's just like the best. It's like so fun, you know, you can, yeah. I think I was reading the Wikipedia page a while back and I think they were actually using it. Some car companies were using it because it was so good at, you know, modeling. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, so it's like, I don't know. I just feel like that kind of thing should be implemented in more just casual games, you know? But yeah, that's kind of what I watched. That was a long tangent. But
interesting.
How about yourself?
A couple of things. One thing I watched was Sunny V2.
Okay.
There's a guy, he just, I think last night, uploaded a video about, you know, the primitive buildings, like, you know, how there are YouTube channels who just keep making primitive stuff. Yeah. So he did like an uncover or like an expose kind of video where he just showed how literally 99% of them are fake. So, yeah, but I think the first one who kind of started this genre was this Australian guy and he reached out to him. But his one seemed the most legit and, cause he did a lot of tried and tested methods. It takes a long time to do the things that he did, but then a lot of the other ones where they seemed to be done by like two or three people, it's actually done by like 10, 12, 14 people with a full on kind of, you know, production and machinery and everything. And and it was just quite interesting to see how, and these are like racking up hundreds and hundreds of millions of views, right? And his point was that these YouTube creators, they don't say that they, like, he would have been okay if it was for entertainment, but they literally say that, oh, we're just two people. It took us months and months to make this kind of thing. Whereas in reality, it's not just two people and months. It's probably 15 people in a week to make all that kind of stuff.
Where's the law on that? Because you're not really selling anything. So
yeah, but the thing is, I think
I'm saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's
wrong. No.
Just, yeah, you know.
I mean, you're right. And how do you even go around something like that, right? And it's just one example. There could be so many more examples that are...
It's like reality TV. You know, sometimes they say this happened this way. But really, you know, everyone knows it's all...
Yeah, but I think with something like this where people do expect a little bit of transparency, that's why YouTube exists, right? Because you don't want the polished stuff that you see on TV. You want something that's a bit more relatable.
Although YouTube's going towards that now.
A little bit. So, yeah, I don't know. But it just, to me, feels like, you know, it's almost like they're getting hundreds of millions of views just built on lies, right? And I think that's where it kind of feels a little bit off.
Yeah, of course. Like, if you know, there's probably three levels. So there's like, oh, this is just entertainment. That's level one. Then level two is kind of like they don't say anything.
Yeah.
And then level three is actually lying and saying, we built this ourselves.
Exactly. And I think one and two is still okay. Like it falls. Like two is definitely something that a lot of marketers do. One is definitely okay where, you know, they're just completely transparent. But three is where they're outlined, saying, oh, this is something that it isn't.
And I guess like, it's kind of sad because it, you know, I think trust in institutions, trust in people, blah, blah, blah. It's all at an all-time low. And I think a lot of it has to do with like social media and like what people post because everyone knows things on Instagram is fake and everything. But there's a lot of people that say like post stuff like to portray that it's real than when it really isn't. And I think when people see that over and over again, they just like get disillusioned and like everything's fake. What's real? And it kind of sucks for the people that are actually doing the, you know, the right thing. So
no, 100%. But yeah, it was an interesting video to watch. I quite like his exposé style stuff where it's quite detailed and not just, you know, done for the sake of drama or anything like that. Yeah. The other thing I watched, so do you know John Oliver? So just watched a video on data brokers. I don't know if you've watched that one, but it's like a piece on how there's...
Oh, is it the one where he like blackmailed US politicians? Yeah.
It's an old one. I saw that last bit ages ago where that went a bit viral. Mm. But I watched the whole thing yesterday, and it's basically about, for those who don't know, it's about this multi-billion dollar industry who basically act as a middleman between place where data is collected, where they then get those data and then they sell it to advertisers or certain groups of people. The way he did it was quite interesting and very funny as well. Yeah. He's obviously, there are stories about political affiliations or somebody going too left or too right, obviously, but ignoring all that kind of stuff, I think what that showed, because I was always on that camp of, oh, I have nothing to hide, so it's okay, like it doesn't really bother me. But then he kind of answered that question as well, that there are others who, like one example that he gave was this domestic violence victim. Basically, her entire data was available online. You could literally pay an X amount of money to someone to get her address, and she's basically scared for her life, right? So there are cases like that, and even I think there was someone in New Hampshire who took like a address of someone just off of those data brokers and ended up murdering that person, right? So United States, obviously, you know, quite different to rest of the world in some cases. Europe's quite strict with these things. Yeah. Australia somewhat. But either way, I think it's not uncommon at this stage to be able to get some of these personal data online.
So did that change your opinion at all when you're like, I got nothing to hide?
I think from a personal level, not so much. But I think from a regulatory, from regulation perspective, I think there is something needs to be done, right? I think, again, for me, it doesn't really bother me, right?
So what if, you know...
For my personal information.
What if little Billy is watching the podcast now? It's like, you know, that Tulsa guy, I don't like him. What would you say then? You know?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends to what extent, right? I think if your personal information, where you're living or who, you know, like your phone number or your everything else is available online, I think that's a risk for anyone. That's something I'm completely against, right? But for the purposes of the way, I guess, the whole idea of cookies was built on the internet, like just to serve you ads that cater to you personally. Like I've found a lot of use out of that. I use online shopping, not to a crazy extent, but every now and then I do it. And if the ad's relevant, I would rather want to get that ad versus something that's not relevant to me.
But you believe people should have the choice to...
100%. Oh, no, of course. Yeah. I don't think it should be the default setting for sure, and that's something he touches on as well. That the way it works right now, the default setting is everything's, you can take all my information, and the whole idea of cookies as well. Like right now, you go on any kind of website, it'll have this big thing about accept all cookies, and the other button would be like change all settings or something. And then when you look at the settings, it's like 20 different options that you can pick and choose from. Now, it is a bit difficult to, you would understand where if I'm part of the selling company, I understand where they're coming from, right? Like you want to make things as frictionless as possible. But at the same time, it's like this privacy we're talking about. So yeah, I'd be on the camp of that everything should be private by default. And then if you want to get relevant ads, you get to choose on top.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. I think the way, or just going back to what John Oliver did, like, because it was like some old US law that he used as an example to get like kind of blackmail the politicians.
Yeah, I'm not even exactly. even old laws. It's basically the fact that it's legal to serve ads to a certain demographic and mine the data. Mm-hmm. So he basically went to target like certain groups of men over 45 years old within the 5-mile radius of the U.S. Capitol. Mm-hmm. And basically data mined
through. I do remember, or maybe it wasn't the full thing, but he was talking about how like there was precedent for this from something else. Like my memory's quite scratchy on it, sure. But like there was another component where like that's why he said it was okay to do. I don't know if that was mentioned or.
I think in general, he put the idea that something like this is legal anyway. So I don't know. Maybe maybe you have to just watch it again.
Yeah.
But worth the watch for sure.
Yeah. Cool stuff. So we have some tech news to go over, don't we?
Yes. Before tech news, I want to actually go some I guess a personal experience. So I got Midjourney. I got accepted to do Midjourney, which is basically an alternative to DALL-E 2. Pretty much almost like for like in a lot of cases. I didn't get it in DALL-E 2, so this Midjourney was a lot more accepting by the looks of it. The way it works is they give you some, you apply for the beta and they accept you in the beta program where they give you a Discord link and you just have to use the Discord link to type in the prompts within Discord and it turns out the images that you want in Discord itself. Right. And I've been using it for a few days now and it's been quite, interesting. Like it's almost profound in some ways because, we spoke about it at length, weeks and weeks ago on the DALL-E 2 episode, you made a video about it. But using it actually is an experience in itself, especially as a creator, as a creative person. I tried different prompts and once it starts giving you the information, it opens up like newer, I guess, ideas in your brain to work on top of what it's giving you. And it almost feels like this endless creative route that you can go on this thing, especially if you're one to kind of, nitpick and look at detail and all that kind of stuff. And I know lots of people are scared that AI is going to take your jobs and all that kind of stuff, which it will in some cases. But for something like this, I think this is how AI is supposed to work in a lot of ways where it can, it's supposed to aid you to open up newer ideas, which you can apply to newer things, right?
So me and my friend, I'll say him, Liam. So he's a computer scientist, he was studying in uni and would have these discussions back in uni. This was just when we graduated, like maybe 2014, 2015, we'd always talk about AI because that was kind of what he was specializing in. And, we came to the conclusion that when AI first comes around, it will be like an assistant to everyone. Mm-hmm. So essentially it'll be like this turbocharging of whatever you can, whether it's the creative field or, whether it's, something to do with medicine or whatever, it can just do a lot of work for you in just this assistant capacity essentially. But then from there, it's kind of going to grow and take on more and more things. But it sounds to me that what you're describing is kind of like that ultimate assistant in your creative pursuit of whatever you want to do. So it's not completely the AI doing it because you're, telling it prompts and directing it. And it's not completely you doing it because the AI is helping you, but you're kind of working together. Mm. And it's more than the sum of its parts because the ideas that you get from it, you could have never got yourself. And it wouldn't have made anything without a prompt. So it's interesting.
And also I think the level of depth and complexity and details it can potentially get to, right? There are so many things that would have taken 10 times as longer for a human to do with some of these prompts. But it's faster, it's more detailed, it's more nuanced. And I think that again opens up so much more opportunities for other fields. Like imagine if you can turn, you can make a video game, like an entire video game with prompts, for example, right? How much faster, what the possibility of it would makes a potential for newer video games that we didn't even think would exist, right? So I think when you think like that, for me, it makes it more exciting in a lot of ways. And going back, I know that when the first cameras came out or things of that sort, where people were really angry, like painters were angry
yeah.
on cameras mm-hmm. because they thought it was going to replace the idea of painting. Mm-hmm. But people still paint today, right? When you look at, like in the world of architecture, you'd have to sit down and do a drafting, like hours and hours and hours of, you know, laborious work, manual work, menial work. That's, again, you know, replaced or cut down to such a small degree. So there will be parts where, you know, sure, like if you are very technical with your career, like if your career's, you know, career is like you're only laying bricks, for example, and that's being done by someone else, I think that's where you lose out. So I think for the future, if you're picking a, I don't know, if you're listening in and if you're picking a profession, I think maybe look at not just picking something that's too technical, that has some room for or wiggle room for, you know, creative input as well.
Okay, so when you're saying technical, do you mean inflexible?
Yeah, like for example, if you specialize in just, I don't know, like tracing on a piece of paper, for example, like you know, like drafting in some ways, like that's your only skill set,
okay. or so narrow skill sets.
Yeah, okay. Like very narrow technical skill sets. I think those are the jobs that are gonna, you know, slowly go away.
So the thing is, this is where it kind of gets to the moment where like it gets hazy, and I'm just like, I don't know, because like the thing about this AI stuff is, you know, the hockey stick moment kind of thing. We're like.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, we're like, wow, it's getting so good. Like, you know, in 10 years, it's going to be like here, but then we don't realize it's going to be a vertical line up. I think, you know, that's why I say I don't know, because it's like this thing is exponential. Mm-hmm. Actually, me and Braden were just talking about it. So DALL-E came out, what, like 3 months ago or something. And then Google Imagen came out like last month. And then there's another one. I think it's called Google. What's the name? Why did I keep forgetting? Google Party, but spelled P-A-R-T-I, I'm pretty sure, stands for something. But so with these models, I hope I'm getting this right because I watched this a long time ago, but with these models, you have like, you know, a certain amount of data that it has, like whether it's, you know, for language models, it's words, or for images, it's a certain number of images. But then, so DALL-E and Google, the first one, Google Imagen, they had like in the order of like 10 to 30 million. And then this new one by Google has in the order of a trillion. A billion. So it's kind of like, you know, this is like exponential already. Like within 3 months, everything's been like, you know, doubled. So it's like you can't tell the trajectory of these things because like, you know, with DALL-E 3, we'll probably start seeing mini videos, and then DALL-E 4 will have like 10-minute, like, not really.
Yeah, like you, full-on full feature film.
It's like make me a Marvel film.
Yeah, it's like, just there.
Yeah. when you were talking about, sorry, we're going a bit long on this, but when you're talking about it opens up new creative possibilities and you can imagine like feature-length films and stuff, it kind of reminds me like, I mean, or kind of not reminds me, but like makes me think like what if this AI had access to like, you know, real world physics and in terms of like making a virtual world and space in terms of a video game. So like it knew what the physical world would be, how it would react, whether that's gravity or light or whatever. So you could say, do this, and then it kind of understands how everything. So it's like make a world where gravity is upside down or whatever and this and that. And it can just kind of make that because it's got like all that stuff in its data set. I think that would be kind of interesting and actually probably possible today.
We're getting there. If you're not there already, I think, like you said, we're just at that moment where things are just about to take off.
Actually, that reminds me, Zuckerberg, he gave a presentation for the metaverse where they used AI to help designers. So it's like put a table over there with some mugs and then you could make it. So I guess we are there.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, crazy stuff.
Yeah, so very good experience. I think anybody can apply for the beta. So if you're listening in and curious, just look up Midjourney and it should be there.
But what? Okay, so versus DALL-E 2, what would you say? Like in terms of
use DALL-E 2 though. So
and what like the images that you've seen, I guess. So in percentages, how much?
So DALL-E 2, from what I've seen, other users' prompts and outputs seem a lot more realistic, a lot more aesthetic, if that makes sense. Midjourney feels more like you need to work around it a bit more. Like you need to like kind of let's say like angle it in certain ways where you want the correct output. Because as it's a Discord thread, like there's lots of different channels where like thousands of people are using it at the same time as yourself. And you can see their prompts and their outputs as well. Right. So some of the stuff that would be coming out is just incredible. So, and I was like looking at their prompts and then starting to copy what they were saying, like you know, like the aspect ratio or just like render in HD plus or something like that. And it changes the outlook as well.
Right.
So things like that, like making it more cinematic, making it in certain angles. And I was just doing those. And I think there's that potential as well. So it felt to me that a little bit more work needs to go on the prompt for Midjourney versus DALL-E 2.
Okay.
But the mini ones, just, yeah, it's just for the memes.
That's just great. I love the mini ones because they're like so crappy that it's just like, this is funny.
One thing I will say though, Midjourney didn't feel like they were very good with faces.
Okay.
So if you just say, I don't know, Elon Musk playing cricket with Bill Gates in Mars or something, you can tell that it's them, but their faces are not very accurate.
Yes. Yeah, so like, as in like not coherent, how it's all smudgy and stuff. Or
yeah,
like,
exactly. Very, very smudgy. Yeah. Not very. But again, I've seen some that are like very good, well structured faces, and they're probably for their 50th, you know, iteration of the same prompt.
Right. Okay.
If that makes sense. I'll stick with the AI side of things. There's this one other story which probably will be a little bit irrelevant for you because you don't follow soccer or sport. Do you know the offside rule?
No. Of course. Hey, I used almost, to play soccer.
You almost said that in a British accent. Of course, mate. So the thing is, obviously, before the prevalence of technology, the offside rule is one of the greatest things in the sport because it'll lead to pub arguments afterwards in a game, right? Plenty of stuff about, because it's, for those who don't play soccer or understand soccer, essentially there's a main umpire or referee in this case, and there's a sideline referee. And it, for, you know, decades, it was up to the...
His eyes.
Yeah, their eyes and basically there was a lot of human error involvement, right? So they'll have to raise a flag as soon as the ball was passed. So I'm not going to explain the complexities of it in this podcast. But the idea of it was that the sideline referee basically would be the one calling the shots if it was offside or not. That was slowly transitioned into this video assistant referee where they would still have that human referee on the side, but then there's a fourth referee who'd be able to watch it from almost like an action replay kind of thing. We'll be able to pause it, look at different camera angles and make the decision quicker. Well, not quicker, but in some ways more accurately. That was the game. So coming up is this new version of that where they'll be able to check the limbs of the players. And the moment there's going to be some sort of a detector within the ball itself that will coincide with the movement of the limbs of the player. And the AI will dictate if it was offside or not. I think they're going to trial that in the World Cup, which is coming in the next 3-4 months. So that will because previously, you know, they didn't have the goal line technology. Now, every time the ball goes completely over, you can tell it's a goal.
I was just going to say, I remember Australia versus Argentina that time when the ball clearly went in and they...
Was it Argentina or Australia? I don't remember. Or was it Korea?
I don't think it was Korea. Okay, Australia versus... I think it was Argentina.
I can't remember when Australia played Argentina. Well, there was England and Germany where the ball hit the thing and it was clear.
This is like 2006, not like recently.
Yeah. Okay. It was in 2006 where England had this one where the ball went all over the line and like everybody saw it from the thing. I think it was right after that when people started talking about, okay, like we should have a goal line technology because it was the highest stage and whatever. But, you know, going back to the idea of that, the reason why I bring this up is, you know, we're getting to a point where there's possibility that the linesman or the referee on the sides would probably become, you know, redundant, right? Because they'll only be used not for so much for the offside, but for you know, closer encounters or things.
Like red cards.
Or just, you know, talking to the referee who couldn't be there at the time. So if we're getting to a point where decisions like this is made by AI, do you think that slowly loses the soul of the sport? Or in other cases, like, you know, where I saw this specific comment about within this report where they said, what's next? Like, the players are all AI as well. And you just have this whole simulation of just AI generated players playing against each other, and everything's like to the dot where there's no human element at all. And because I feel there is some sort of argument to be made.
I get that.
I get that as well. And I was like that, like, especially when VAR came in, I was like, oh man, like, I don't care if it's offside or not. I just like the fact that there's something to talk about with others, and it just brings that human element to the game. But now I'm thinking, yeah, it's a probably a legitimate argument.
Yeah. In terms of losing the soul, I can see both sides. Like, some people, like, we want the game to be as fair as possible. You know, we don't want any referees like siding or like making mistakes or human error, whether it's that or corruption or whatever. I can understand that. And then the other side where it's like, you know, it's a human sport where like things can happen that are unpredictable and whatever. And some of that excitement comes from, you know, bad calls from referees and all of this. So as for which side that I lean towards, I kind of do like the referees kind of making mistakes and everything. It's kind of gives another element of like, you know, are you blind? Is the ref blind? That's what I always used to say. But yeah, so like...
But it doesn't just have to be from the context of soccer or football in this case, right?
Okay.
So imagine like any other sport, or like even in the idea of music, where a lot of people were totally against, you know, electronic music being introduced in the world, or that fact, right? So I don't know, how does that make you feel in terms of technology taking over? Because a lot of people really look down upon, say, you know, just using your fingers to press a few buttons and make music, right? But so much has been done with that aspect of things. So
I guess, well, from that point, like pressing your buttons and making pressing some buttons and making music, I think that comes from a lack of understanding of what's
what
being
the buttons
done.
Do.
Like, oh, even if they are buttons, but like, yeah, because it's still playing instruments, but just in a different way, essentially. Yeah. But in terms of AI, like, say, getting into music or something, it depends on the degree. Like, if it's going to make the whole song, then it'll be cool to listen to. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, there's no human element in there. It's essentially an amalgamation of all the data that it's got from humans to make something new. But one human, like, didn't come out through the channel of any human. So it's a bit of a weird thing. I don't think I'm 100% on board for that to be like mass produced. So like, say Google creates this company that creates number one hits every day. Like, it's, you know, that's, who wants to live in a world like that? It's like engineered to be like the perfect earworm where everyone just loves it. Like, that's not, you know. So that's one aspect. But yeah, in terms of AI taking over, I think there is something that's unsettling about it in terms of, it's kind of like, well, we're humans. We've been doing this for thousands of years. This has come from like this culture, or like, you know, this experience has made this person come up with this idea or like whatever. And then just to have an AI come and, you know, do something better than all of us ever could. It's kind of,
it's when I like reading up on times when newer technology were introduced for us, which we take for granted, or just something we've lived, like headphones or something. But then I look up the period when headphones were first introduced, right? People were like hating on it. People thought that the world was going to, that people were going to die on the streets with their headphones on. Like, that's literally what they thought. Like, if you look at the media outcry, the local outcry.
You should see this one about electricity in like 1900-something. Like, there's like people getting zapped in the street. It's like, say no to AC power.
Exactly. That's what I mean, right? And in fact, there's one interesting story, again, going back to the music example. People used to think, the idea of music being stored digitally or for people to play it again came in quite later, obviously. You know, like the fact that you can store music via data into a disc and then, or vinyl, and then replay it, right? Prior to that, all music was basically, you know, the fact that you say, oh, let's listen to some music, would mean that somebody would get up on stage or some, you have an instrument or something, and then you play together or something like that, right? There was no alternative to a concert, or if you wanted to see some organized performance, it would be via stage. So when the alternative came where you could store music, there was like lots of outcry against that. Mm. So much so that they started calling it dead music, mm. like the music has died. Mm. And that's where the term live music has come from. So the alternative to that is that's actually cool. live music.
That's cool.
So wow. that's what you call live music yeah, now, yeah, because that music is alive.
Didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. But that whole point in time, like people who were like performers, people who would be like on stage and things like that, they were like against anything that was opposite to quote unquote live music, right?
Well, think about it though. It's very understandable for them because that's their livelihood. Exactly. So this was a big threat. Like people have to go and see them. Like now they can just listen
to it whenever they wanted to, right? And the whole idea of it, and some parts of it is actually on Stranger Things as well. And the latest, I guess the hysteria of how there's, you know, some certain stories and how people react to certain stories without really knowing the truth. That hysteria, I think, is present today as well. So when I look at that, okay, news about AI has come out where it might really quote unquote improve or build on certain creative or I guess sport or, and the whole idea is not it's going to take away the soul from it, is the same argument that was made even before we had digital music, right? So that's the angle that where my brain goes to every time I hear something negative about something new that comes out on. Mm-hmm. That, oh, maybe we're just too early in the process to understand what it's going to do.
Yeah.
But then this other part of me thinks, oh, but we've never really had something like AI before.
Yeah. And that's, I'm kind of more on the second part. Like I understand like that everyone, it's the natural instinct for everyone to be scared. And a lot of that might be overhyped. Like, you know, people are always scared of new things, but AI is just another thing. I mean, well, is it? Another thing entirely. We've never had a recreation of cognition before.
Yeah.
That's basically it. You know, that's exponential. That's the two things that,
yeah.
you know. So, back to the soccer thing. I think, it loses a bit of soul, but I can see both sides of the argument, essentially.
Mm. Cool. Well, there's a bit of a route around there, but I thought that was an interesting discussion. But guess who's, you know, how you made the I'm back video. Guess who's back on our podcast? Like the topic we haven't spoken about in a while.
Oh yeah, Musky Boy.
Are we calling him that now?
Yeah, Musky Boy.
He's back on the conversation.
Yeah.
As of this Friday, because apparently he no longer wants the Twitter deal.
Yeah. Was it because of the bot thing, and then now Twitter's suing him?
Yeah. So I'll just read off. Yeah. From here. So Elon Musk is officially trying to pull out of his $44 billion agreement to purchase Twitter. In a filing Friday afternoon, Musk's team claims that he's terminating the deal because Twitter was in material breach of their agreement and had made false and misleading statements during the negotiations. And apparently he's been trying to get information about how many daily active users Twitter has, and also the fact that Twitter has a problem with bots. In fact, only yesterday, apparently, it removed 1 million spam accounts a day. In the filing, Mr. Musk also repeatedly been refused information about the number of bot accounts, which is why he wished to terminate the deal. Elon Musk, though, has already put pen to paper on the deal, and it's not totally clear whether he can back out at this stage, which means that he'll have to prove that Twitter breached their agreement. Otherwise, he's got some lawsuits in his hands.
Right. Well, good luck to him. This is, it's just been one hell of a roller coaster with this guy, I think.
Why do you think he's to me, it sounds like the fact that Twitter's withholding information from him just seem a bit, like he can obviously buy and decide to just look at things, right? But to me, it just feels like there's something else probably been going wrong. But from your perspective, why do you think he's pulling out now?
There could be a number of reasons. I think maybe it's market conditions have changed. Like it's firing a lot of people from Tesla.
I think so too.
He's, you know, obviously his bottom line's really going to the bottom. So I think maybe that might, you know, 44 billion.
Billion.
Yeah. Just for a second, I was like, what? Yeah. $44 billion isn't, you know, money to just throw around in a time like this. So maybe that's his main driver, but I I'm not in his head, so I don't know.
Yeah, same. I mean, we're purely speculating here, but I think that's the case as well. Since the Twitter announcement, Tesla stock's been nosediving. I think just the fact that he's going to get involved with yet another big behemoth of a company means that, you know, I think there's some fear or some, mostly the fact that they think he might not be able to take up on more stuff, especially he's, you know, dealing with SpaceX and Tesla. And those are, you know, like their stock's been falling rapidly and the market's bad. And the fact that you have to get $44 billion at a time like this with everything else kind of just crashing and crumbling around you.
Not good. So just today, earlier, I think he tweeted something about the situation. It was like one of those memes where it was like actually himself laughing slowly more and more in each photo. And then it had like text saying like, you know, Twitter wanted me to said I couldn't buy it, and then now they have to go to court, and now they have to reveal the bot numbers and court documents, and it's like laughing really hard.
Right.
I think he's taking the piss.
Yeah,
I
think he also feels like he thinks he's invincible kind of thing. But I think sometimes like this is the part where he's trying to still put that face up front that maybe he's trying to be invincible, but I don't know. He'll probably get hit with a few lawsuits for sure.
Yeah. Don't they both have to pay $1 billion or something?
I don't know what that's about.
I saw that somewhere. But because I read both parties do, and I was like, that's a bit weird. Like
for what?
For like not going through with the deal.
To whom?
To each other. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. That's what I was like. Did I read that?
So we don't go through. I'm gonna pay $1 billion.
You're gonna pay me
$1 billion.
Yeah, that's just all lose money. So
I mean, nobody's losing money. Well, it depends when they inflation. So it depends what time of the day they're doing the transaction. Somebody will lose out a fair bit on inflation if it's like, I don't know, 30 seconds after.
Oh man. I think this this flu's gotten to my head. All right.
But yeah, it will be interesting to see that space span out over the next few weeks or months. Who knows at this stage? But it seems like he's definitely trying to end the deal right there. Uber leaks have come out that says that how it spread it's quote unquote effing illegal ride sharing globally. So basically there's this leak, an expose of lots of files that shows how they were at the forefront of lobbying with politicians.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
With bending rules, bending local laws. Essentially it came out to, I think it was leaked to The Guardian, and I think they're the ones who broke the story. The leak also shows that how Uber tried to show support by discreetly quoting prime ministers, presidents, billionaires, oligarchs, and media barons. In addition to memos and presentations and notebooks, the documents also includes, you know, emails, messages, WhatsApp exchanges between Silicon Valley giants' most senior executives. Not surprising, given that I've watched Super Pumped,
right?
Where they kind of detailed a lot of interesting stuff. I think there was this whole episode called Grey Ball. The concept of that was that this was the early stages of Uber. And obviously they took some creative freedom to showcase that. But the idea of greyballing was that Uber could look at somebody's phone and look them up on the back end and basically stop them from ordering any Ubers around that area. Okay. Apparently this is something that wasn't legal back then. I don't know if it's legal now anyway. But they were doing it to specifically people from the government who are trying to stop for Uber from spreading. So this was at a time when there was no, you know, clear cut legislations or laws around somebody driving an Uber. So there'd be people from the government going around or from the local council going around getting like you know hailing Uber rides, they'd get in the car and smack them with fines that you can't do this here. Wow. So they caught wind of that and basically they greyballed these individual officials around that area, which apparently became like a big deal later on, even in the show itself. So stuff like that was very fairly commonly showed, and I'm guessing it's common knowledge. So this news of them being illegally spreading everywhere wasn't a big surprise to me, but this is does that come as a surprise to you?
Not really. Yeah, I've heard Uber doing dodgy things in the early days. But the thing is, like, yes, so this leaks. What happens now? Like, it's nothing. Nothing can really be done.
Yeah, they already released like a statement saying that this was a time where we practice these things openly, but this is a company has changed since then, blah, blah, blah. And they mentioned, like, Travis Kalanick, who's the CEO at the time, being the forefront of all these things, but he's no longer there. Yeah. So they, I guess, know how to save their face, yeah. But to me, it sounds like this is something that I guess pretty much any big Silicon Valley company would have done at some point, be it Facebook, obviously. Yeah. Be it,
the Windows Phone video that I did, something interesting that I didn't include was that Google was actually kind of strong-handing Microsoft and, you know, refusing to give them, you know, key apps like YouTube and and all that and Gmail. And so, yeah, Google made it really hard for Microsoft to succeed. So it was kind of like there could be a lawsuit in there kind of thing. But, yeah, I think these big tech giants just stomp everyone.
There was actually this one interesting part within the video, within the Super Pumped TV show itself, where one of his investors was telling Travis that, you know, like don't like go down that path of just being a maniac and trying to destroy everything or because Travis almost he was portrayed almost as a psychopath, almost, right? A sociopath in this case, where he was just trying to destroy everything on his way, right? And the investor said that, hey, don't be like those people. And he's like, oh, Google also did do that. And then the investor said, don't be evil. Does that ring any bell? But then again, he replied, remember, what was that search engine that was there before Google? Labyrinth or something?
Excite? Dogpile? Ask Jeeves?
No, it was the company that Google kind of took over. I think I remember sharing with you on WhatsApp and asked, hey, do you know about this company? I forgot the name.
Google took over.
Like, they didn't take over, but they destroyed, like...
internet browser or search?
Search.
Oh, okay.
They're one of the first search... You know the company for sure, because when I asked you about it, you were like, oh, yeah, the search engine company.
So it wasn't Excite.
Was it called?
Excite.
Probably not. It was in the mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah. But...
Was probably Excite? I don't know.
Well, like, maybe when you say the name, I just got to say I'm not on my best form today.
Yeah. So. When it comes to maybe they paid $1 billion to each other to settle that.
Yeah, man.
No, but the idea of that was that Travis kind of came back at the universe and said, hey, but Google actually destroyed that company. So don't come to me with this moral BS, because that's how you go, what you're going to do to survive around here, right? And I think that was the angle where it kind of shows how big companies kind of do this stuff on the regular. Mm. And I wouldn't be surprised if more and more leaks like this come out.
Yeah. It's just the way it happens.
That's right. Final one for the day. Yeah, we're here almost 50 minutes. Wow. Didn't feel like it.
Yeah.
Final one for the day. There is a horrifying loan scheme that allows people to buy NFTs in installments.
Ooh.
Would you sign up to that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
100,000%, man.
So cryptocurrency loans company Teller Finance is literally applying the logic of layaway to non-fungible tokens. And it's funny the way they're ordered, because apparently the crypto community can sink even lower. As Decrypt reports, Teller Finance is launching its aptly named Ape Now Pay Later program. To allow users to give each other loans to buy NFTs on the Ethereum blockchain.
Really? This is unbelievable. So it's like...
Especially now.
You're getting into debt in the bottom of a market with things that don't exist. like to buy things that don't exist. That's what else can you say? That's like unbelievable. All right. Well, yeah, that's obviously a great investment opportunity. No one should take it, but I'm just saying it's
yeah, just to be clear, we're not giving any financial advice here. But yeah, it's just when I saw this on the ticker, it's I've been on the not championing NFTs, but more on the idea of NFTs. But it seems to me like all this stuff's almost just the way it's been crumbling around around the whole space. Yeah. It's almost telling in some ways how a lot of it was just hype built around it.
Yeah.
And when you look at what's going on right now with people still trying to push it, it almost feels like there's, I don't know, some, it does feel a bit scammy. Majority of it does. Mm. So yeah, I don't know where it's going to go from here, at least the NFT side of things, but.
The core concept of NFTs, like in some use cases, obviously like everything can be used properly, but we've not seen any of that. This has all been just a quick cash grab. And I think what's interesting is that even though the market has completely decimated itself, like there's still scams going on out there, like about NFTs, and everyone has like such a negative sentiment on it, but people are still like willing to push more. Yeah, actually, I was watching a video on I don't know if it was Vice, but you know the Bored Ape Club, they had their first meetup
in New York.
Yeah,
and I think I saw it too.
Yeah, and just how like ridiculous everything was. And there was a guy that was interviewing people on the street saying like, "What do you think about NFTs?" And everyone was like, "Nah."
Yeah, I think I saw that as well. And I think he also talked about how one of the events had Eminem and Snoop Dogg perform or something like that, because they also push NFTs quite heavily, and then they're involved in that whole scene. But then he also said that, I mean, this isn't really a unique perk because you'd probably be spending $300, $400 a ticket if you really have to, you know, get even like the VIP seats or something to watch Eminem or Snoop Dogg instead of, I don't know, like paying tens of thousands of dollars for data.
And it's kind of like, well, yeah, maybe they'll have concerts in the future, but like still it will take a long time to repay that value, like, you know, $10,000 for an NFT. And then, yeah, there was also that part about the knockoff Snoop Dogg where like lower tier people got
something.
The name is Switch. Noob Snog or something.
Something like that.
But
people thought it was the real guy.
He looked pretty similar, but but I think loans for NFTs is a terrible, terrible idea.
And I think I saw another headline as well. I didn't go deep into it. Somebody lost his entire savings, like house savings, trying to put money on certain NFTs and stuff. And you hear stories like this, like more and more. I think people just putting in their life savings on such volatile markets. So
That's a bizarre thing that I don't think I'd really ever understand. Mm. Like, because it's a simple process to be, you know, at that computer desk or whatever or on your phone saying, if this goes wrong, what would happen? Think about the consequences here. Yeah. And they just clearly haven't done that.
And I think that's also one of the reasons why you know, ColdFusion wanted to get into that game initially because we're still trying to understand, but you decided to kind of take it slow and understand the market first. And obviously now you're not planning to release it.
Yeah. So the way that it was going to be done was, it did have utility, but this was all very small scale. Yeah. Like it was kind of like, you know, on the scale of Patreon kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was kind of exploring the idea and it seemed interesting. I think that the sentiment around it just got more and more negative. Yeah. There were more and more scams and it just got more and more of a cesspit. So I was like, yeah, nah.
Yeah, probably a very good decision in hindsight.
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure.
On that note, we have a Through the Web NFT launching next week.
Uh-huh. 10
on the DeGogo blockchain.
there's only one node. You know.
You can only get the Braden coin, which is like the perfectly minted version.
You know, and it's also a, what do you call it? One of those... See, I can't think tonight. I was trying to say what Luna was, the self-balancing.
The whole concept of it's an indication. It's time we wrap up.
It's This is our first nighttime podcast. That probably explains a few things.
That does. I'm also quite low on energy today, so I guess that's where we end things.
So on that note, guys. All right, thanks for watching, and we'll see you again next time for the next episode. Actually,
we'll have a separate announcement on what's going to happen.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Oh yeah, thanks for watching, guys, and we'll see you again soon.